From WXXI News, I'm Jasmine Singer, and this is Environmental Connections. Today's Environmental Connection began right down the road at the University of Rochester's Medical Center. Each time I've passed by the constant stream of smoke from their power plant, I've wondered what kind of environmental impact does the healthcare system have? My guess is that it goes well beyond what's in one smokestack. Between the U of R and Rochester Regional Health's medical systems, over 45,000 Rochesterians are employed by the local healthcare systems. They are, of course, major powerhouses in the local economy and people's daily routines. But one of the lesser-known consequences of these healthcare systems is the extent of their impact on the local environment. So the question looms: what are these organizations doing to reduce their carbon footprints, given their dominance over the economy in the area? Today's episode of Environmental Connections focuses on the different steps that these healthcare systems are taking in a new world of hospital sustainability and what work is still left to do. Joining me in the studio today to unpack these ideas are Dr. Mike Waller, Director of Sustainability at Rochester Regional Health, and Dr. Jane Van Dis, co-founder of OBGYNs for a Sustainable Future. Welcome, Dr. Waller and Dr. Van Dis.
Thanks, Jasmine.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So great to have both of you. And it's great to have our remote guest today, Heidi Fritz, who is the healthcare director of Greener by Default. Welcome, Heidi.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Our guests are going to give us an inside look at how healthcare systems can address sustainability in their daily operations. And I am so excited about this episode. Dr. Waller, as Director of Sustainability for Rochester Regional Health, could you start by talking about the biggest sources of carbon emissions at the medical center and strategies that Rochester Regional Health has implemented to cut those emissions?
Sure. Well, for those who are not quite as familiar, we try to get our hands around the different types of emissions by dividing them into three different scopes. We call them scopes 1, 2, and 3. Scope one are sources that are generated on-site from your operation. So that includes things like natural gas combustion, tailpipe emissions from any kind of vehicles. For healthcare systems, there's actually quite a bit of emissions that are generated from waste anesthetic gases. So anytime somebody goes under anesthesia, those gases get vented to the atmosphere, and they're thousands of times more potent than carbon dioxide. So that's all in scope one. Scope two is basically the emissions from electricity. And then scope three is everything else. And scope three, that includes all of the emissions from all the supplies that are purchased, and so all of the emissions that come from the manufacturing, delivering those supplies to the hospitals, that is typically the largest category of emissions, but it's also the most difficult to actually get an accurate number. So there's a lot of groups that have tried to estimate it, and they say it's about 75 to 80% of the total emissions for most healthcare systems. It's also the most difficult to get your hands on and actually try to figure out ways to reduce it. So we tend to just focus on scopes 1 and 2 because we can more easily manage those.
The medical center doesn't have its own power plant, right?
Not at any of our locations. We don't have any on-site generation other than the generators that sometimes we have to use.
So does that make it easier to prioritize renewable energy and energy efficiency since you're not tied to running your own facility? And I should also add, does it also help balance the financial and environmental incentives when you're making energy decisions?
I think really with any technology, there are solutions out there to make them more efficient and to use renewables, even if you have, say, an on-site natural gas power plant or using some other fossil fuel. You know, there are ways that you can buy carbon offsets to offset the emissions, for example. But at the end of the day, you know, I think the biggest challenge, at least for my job, is how do we reduce our emissions in a cost-effective manner that our C-suite will accept? And so that's where I spend most of my time focusing on is, you know, how can we actually save money while switching to renewables, which we've fortunately been pretty successful, at least in the time that I've been there.
Tell me why. Brag a little.
Well, you know, I learned, so when I started, we have a new CEO now, but when I started, our former CEO, his name was Eric Bieber. on my first day on the job, he said, Mike, nobody knows what healthcare sustainability is, so you're kind of going to have to make it up. And then he said, I'm also still trying to convince people why I'm paying you. And then he literally kicked me out of his office.
Okay.
So, you know, I kind of took from that, you know, I really need to focus on the financial savings. So pretty much when people ask me, what do I do? I tell them that I pretty much just save money for the health system with an environmental flair to it.
And so you have to speak their language.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, depending on the audience, I'll either just start with the savings and I'll be like, oh, by the way, we're reducing our environmental footprint. Or, you know, if it's a group like this, we can talk about the environmental stuff. And by the way, we're saving, you know, millions of dollars as well doing these things.
So I know that some healthcare facilities are also exploring ways to generate their own green energy, whether that's through solar panels or wind power or even geothermal heating systems. Has Rochester Regional Health considered any of those approaches?
Yeah, so we have a goal by the end of this year that 100% of our electricity would come from renewables.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Which my job is to finish that. Yeah. And so at the end of this year, I'm a little nervous about making sure that we achieve it. So
you just said it in front of Jane Van Dis too, so you're going to be held accountable.
Well, we're actually doing pretty well. So when we tallied it up, we're at about 76%.
Wow.
And so we have some plans in place where we think we can at the very least have projects under contract by the end of this year to meet that goal. So we plan to do that, but we basically are doing it with just a lot of solar. And we do have some geothermal, but that really doesn't make a dent. The renewables, we're able to achieve that pretty much just boils down to solar because it's the cheapest form. We also purchase a lot of hydropower as well.
That's awesome.
Wow.
And we really don't have much wind, but that's another potential option that's being explored.
So in researching for this episode, we found that the highest contribution to global warming from healthcare comes from the United States. So let me share some stats. Our healthcare contributes 10% of all U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, or over one-fifth of the healthcare contributions to climate change globally. And 71% of the carbon emissions in healthcare comes from the healthcare supply chain. I want to talk about what that tells us about the most urgent changes that need to be made. So to help us answer that, let's turn to Dr. Jane Van Dis. Dr. Van Dis, from where you sit, what is the most significant source of emissions in healthcare?
Well, as Mike mentioned, and as your statistic outlined, somewhere between 70 and 80% of all emissions in healthcare come from those scope 3 emissions, which is the supply chain. And so in a hospital or in a healthcare setting, there are obviously purchase managers in all sorts of departments, and they are in charge of supplying all the necessary elements to provide the healthcare that we do. So, for instance, all of the pharmaceuticals, and importantly, pharma contributes up to 4.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions and up to 25% of a hospital's emissions. So all the little decisions that a purchaser makes in deciding what types of medicines, what the vehicles for distributing those medicines are, whether or not they're using the metered dose inhalers, which, as Mike mentioned, those also contribute their direct greenhouse gas emissions. So there are tiny, tiny purchasing decisions along that supply chain that add up to that 80%. And I will say that importantly, I hope we can talk about this at some point, Jasmine, is also the waste stream, because that also gets lumped in with the supply chain in terms of the things that are purchased and then those things after they have had their use, how much emissions comes from their disposal.
Let's do that. Let's talk about the waste created in the hospital. My wife tells me that she remembers a time in the 90s when her campus health services would autoclave medical instruments. Dr. Van Dis, can you talk to us about where waste comes from and whether reusing equipment could play a role in reducing both waste and emissions?
Yeah, so it's great because you can hit two birds with one stone. Not that I want to hit any birds in the bird
feed two birds
bird,
with one
bird,
seed.
Feed two birds, exactly. And I should say at the outset, Jasmine, I want to make clear, I am an OBGYN practicing at URMC, at the University of Rochester. However, I also started an organization called OBGYNs for Sustainable Future, and this is actually an interest group of Healthcare Without Harm. So Healthcare Without Harm is a global organization that helps healthcare organizations to decarbonize and to think about how they can become champions for both decreasing their emissions, but also the pollution in their communities. So nothing I say here today is as a representative of the University of Rochester. However, I obviously practice in that setting, so I have a lot of experience. So back to your question about waste, there again are tiny, tiny decisions that are made in every single clinical situation for which you might have the opportunity for choosing something that is reusable versus single use. And so a perfect example in my area of expertise is the speculum, which for the women out there, they might not have fond memories of this device, which we use to perform a pap smear, screening for cervical cancer, et cetera. But what's interesting is that actually the metal speculums, which to your wife's point do require autoclaving, the metal speculums actually have less emissions. So there was a great study that was performed a couple of years ago. And what they did was they looked at the carbon emissions of plastic speculum versus metal speculum over the course of the year. And what they found is that the plastic speculum, when you include the emissions associated with the disposal of those plastic speculums, was actually over four times high. So four times the carbon emissions for the plastic versus the metal. We see this as well in decisions about drapery. When we use reusable drapery, for instance, in surgical procedures, there's no difference in infection rate, but there's a huge difference in the emissions of single-use plastic drapery, which is the norm across healthcare, and reusable cloth drapery. So again, tiny, tiny decisions, all of which, when added up, account for that 80% of those emissions.
I want to go back to URMC because, as you mentioned, that's not what you're specifically representing today. URMC was asked to be on today's episode, and unfortunately, they were not able to join us. But they did email me this morning and asked me to share how deeply committed they are to making healthcare more sustainable. They say they've been working on this for over 25 years. They say that they focus on practical challenges beyond recycling, things like reducing waste and saving energy, and as they say, supporting local food systems, which we'll get back to. So that is good to know, but I'm very grateful that we can dig in a little bit more with our guests who were able to show up today. And I want to ask you one more question before we go to Heidi, Dr. Van Dis. Hospitals also rely on sustainable procurement, so purchasing materials and equipment with environmental impact in mind. So what should hospitals prioritize when making these decisions?
Well, actually, I think that there is a false sense of having a better device or a better thing when it is single use. And I do think that given that the plastics industry is 25% of GDP, the fossil fuel oil industry is 6% of GDP, there's a way in which the procurement and the selling to doctors, to purchase managers, et cetera, that single use is better, has infiltrated all of healthcare to very deleterious aims. And it's interesting, speaking to Mike's point about cost sensitivity, it's been shown that actually reusable surgical instruments are 19 times lower cost than single-use surgical instruments. And yet, if you talk to any surgeon, they'll probably tell you that they think that it costs less, right, because it's made of plastic. So there's a way in which the advertising and the marketing and all of the sales representatives within the healthcare industry have pushed plastic, pushed single use on us. And I will say it's really interesting. I know you've had here in this studio people from RIT and the University of Rochester who are measuring the amount of plastics in the waterways around Monroe County. And we know that these plastics are having very deleterious health effects on our unborn children in the womb. I'm an obstetrician, so those are the patients that I care for, but also children's health, adults' health, et cetera. And so there's all sorts of ways in which this plastic ecosystem, of which the healthcare and hospital systems are a huge generator. In fact, the healthcare is the largest generator of plastic waste in the United States, generating over 5 million tons of waste per year. And then we in healthcare are also the biggest consumer of single-use plastic. And importantly, Jasmine, as your audience probably doesn't know, less than 5% of that plastic in healthcare is recycled. So it is either going into the landfill, which is making its way into the water, or it's getting incinerated in our red bags, which are our medical waste bags. And then, unfortunately, those chemicals then are going up in the air.
Wow.
Can I
answer this? You know, for actual solutions, it really just boils down to the age-old mantra of reduce, reuse, recycle.
Yes.
And I get a lot of frustrated that so many people focus on that recycling piece when it, you know, people come and try to say that they want to recycle everything and throw everything in our single-stream bins, but it's such a small amount of the materials and such a small impact on the overall emissions reduction efforts that we're trying to achieve. The best thing that any healthcare professional can do is to reduce first, so figure out what are the things they don't need to buy or use and then stop buying them, and then switch to reusables. If they can find an alternative product for whatever item that they use on a daily basis, and then after that, figure out ways to recycle it.
Yeah.
But starting at the beginning of just the reduction step is huge. And the people, if there are any healthcare professionals that are listening, the people who have the most power and authority in this are the physicians and the nurses, because they're the ones that direct the items that they want to use. And then after that, it's the purchasing team. So there's a whole group of purchasing folks in the background for all of the healthcare systems that are really the ones testing and deciding which products that we use. And they're the ones that talk to the vendors and tell them what the nurses and the physicians want to use and want to see in their products. And so those are the teams that can really have an impact on this.
Having said that, I do think there are these regulatory bodies and some more of these policy bodies that do play a role as well. So a perfect example is, for instance, that a lot of hospitals require physicians and nurses to use the plastic bouffant caps when they're in the operating room, when in fact there has been shown to be no difference in infection using a cloth reusable scrub cap. And so sometimes what you'll see is the healthcare system will say you have to use the single use, even though there's no data to support that the single use is better or that it prevents infection.
Okay. Wow. You guys are blowing my mind. I just want you to know that, like, not in a great way, but I am so, you know, happy to hear that there are efforts being done here. It's just one of those stats that it's overwhelming, to say the very least. If you're just tuning in, join me in being overwhelmed and excited by our guests today. I'm Jasmine Singer, and you're listening to Environmental Connections. Once a month, we move Evan over a little bit and take over the mic for Environmental Connections. And today, we're being joined by Dr. Mike Waller, the Director of Sustainability at Rochester Regional Health, Dr. Jane Van Dis, co-founder of OBGYNs for a Sustainable Future, and Heidi Fritz, who is the Healthcare Director at Greener by Default. Heidi, let's turn to you. I want to talk about hospital food service, because most people don't realize the enormous carbon footprint of institutional food systems and the fact that a pretty substantial percentage of a hospital's emissions come from the cafeteria and food service. So I'd love if you could talk a little bit about that. What is the percentage? And can you tell us more about what role food plays in a hospital's overall sustainability impact?
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes, I think it's important for people to realize that obviously food does make up a huge amount of all healthcare emissions. I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot in a percentage. It makes up 10 to 12% of all healthcare emissions. But there's a great opportunity there to cut emissions more easily without a whole lot of upfront investments. So what we do at Greener by Default is that we work with institutional food service to help transition menus and make menu changes that reduce those carbon and water footprints that meet sustainability and health goals, while also making it easy for patients to have freedom of choice. But we look at choosing plant-based foods and putting that front and center on menus. Because we know that there's a huge impact. You know, 1/3 of greenhouse gas emissions worldwide are food related. And again, in healthcare, food makes up 10 to 12% of all of that. But plant-based foods are a great way to cut emissions, because plant-based meals have on average half of the carbon footprint of animal-based meals. And it really makes a difference to sustainability as well as other aspects of the quintuple aim of healthcare.
New York City Health and Hospitals implemented plant-based meals for inpatients, reducing food-related carbon emissions by, I think, 36% in just 1 year. What were the biggest takeaways from that initiative? And more importantly, for us here in Rochester, how replicable is it for other hospital systems?
Yeah, New York City Health and Hospitals did an amazing job, and we were able to partner with them on their initial pilot that they did a couple years ago to introduce more plant-based meals as the default on their menus. So what that means is that people are offered a plant-based chef special and actually two different plant-based chef specials. And then if they don't want those, they're offered other menu options, which include meat and dairy as well. But basically what we found in that initial pilot was there were about 60% of patients that were eligible for the plant-based meals that decided to stick with that plant-based default. So just having that nudge as the preferred option, the first option that was listed, it's a healthy option, it's a hearty, it's full of protein, but 50% or 60% of patients actually stuck with that default and were happy to eat a plant-based meal. So it turns out really most people are flexitarians at heart and happy to eat plant-based when it's delicious. But the other piece of what we found in New York City is that they had a tremendous cost savings potential as well.
Are you working with other cities to implement this? How replicable is it?
Yes, we are. New York City Health and Hospitals was just one of the institutions that we've worked with. We're working with hospitals across the country as well as in Canada and the UK right now. It's different with each hospital because every system may have a different menu style or a different food service operation. But the strategies that we're using are really flexible and can apply to any of those types of food service operations. So it is replicable. We're using some behavioral science strategies and influencing choice architecture, which is able to be used in any setting.
I was going to ask you, I mean, not to get too derailed here, but I wanted to know if there have been challenges in changing perceptions about plant-based meals, because, you know, I'm in full disclosure, I'm a longtime vegan, and I am used to those things that people say as they're looking at you askew when you're trying to, you know, feed them some tofu. What have you encountered with your work?
Yeah, this is great. I think that there's certainly challenges about changing perceptions in that, you know, really only about 10% of diners actually identify as vegetarian or vegan. And so then people think, well, you know, if that's all, why are we serving plant-based foods to everyone? So there's this fear that there's going to be some pushback. But we're really not suggesting those menu changes just be for the vegetarians and vegans. We want to make plant-based food appealing and accessible to all diners. And what we found is that when it's framed well and when the food is delicious, you really don't see that pushback, especially because there's still choice. There's still meat and dairy options available as well on the menu. So that fear of pushback is one challenge to overcome. I think the other one is really comfort foods. There's often an emphasis on wanting to provide people with familiar comfort foods when they're in the hospital and they're recovering. But oftentimes that's translated on the menu to mean things that are just heavy, less healthy foods that are maybe high in fat and cholesterol. And so we're really not doing anybody any good with that. And what we've found is that it's not so much those, you know, traditional standard American diet comfort foods. It's really about the familiar flavor profiles and having culturally relevant dishes that offers comfort.
So I don't want to put you on the spot here because I know that the focus of Greener by Default is that sort of plant-based by default. But I am curious if you have any insight into this. In the URMC's commitment to sustainability that they sent me this morning, one of the things they mentioned was that they focus on local food and sourcing food from nearby farms as part of their commitment to helping to address this issue. They want to support local agriculture, which they say reduces the food supply's carbon footprint. Can you speak a little bit about the local food and also composting, if that's also part of what you do?
Sure. In terms of local food, I mean, I think that's great. It's always good to support local and sustainable food systems. At the same time, we do know that, the transport cost, for example, of food is, in terms of carbon emissions, is far less related to the amount of distance that food has to travel. It's much more related to what that food actually is. So, you know, there's quite a difference in the emissions of different types of proteins, for example, and things like beans and lentils and fruits and vegetables are much lower carbon emissions, no matter where you get them from.
And do you happen to know about whether composting is part of any hospital cafeterias' commitments to sustainability? And again, I'm probably putting you on the spot, but it just occurred to me.
No problem at all. And yeah, there's certainly, you know, there's quite a bit of food waste in hospitals. That's for a variety of reasons. And composting is certainly a great idea. It's not our area of expertise with Greener by Default. We don't specifically work on composting projects with hospitals, but we encourage them if they already have some such a program. You know, we would certainly want to encourage them to continue that. But ideally, I think, as one of the other guests mentioned, you know, you want to go upstream and really prevent as much food waste as possible to begin with, so you don't even get to the point of needing to compost it.
It's a really great point.
I can jump on the food waste thing.
Please.
Pretty quickly, because we've done quite a few food waste audits at our hospitals and some of our other administrative buildings. And at least in the hospitals, the majority of the food waste actually comes from uneaten patient food. It's like over 90% of the food waste. And so a lot of hospitals do a really good job upstream trying to reduce, you know, try to not over prepare and make too much food. But we are required to give food to patients, but they're not required to eat it. And so as you can imagine, a lot of folks in the hospital, you know, they don't feel like eating.
Right.
And so those, you know, there'll be full trays, and it's really difficult to capture that, because you would have to have a separate bin to put that food waste into, and then bring it down to a separate, separate place in the waste room. And that logistical effort in the hospital is pretty difficult. So we actually do compost at some of our facilities. It's a challenge. And so each facility is unique, and it takes quite a bit of effort just to figure out that whole process.
And have you heard about Greener by Default, or just the idea of transforming the menus because of the animal products and the relation to that when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions?
Yeah, I have not heard of Greener by Default, and I'd love to connect afterwards. But we've attempted similar efforts. And I have to say, I haven't been very successful in most locations, but we have made a little bit of progress in a few. But, you know, trying to get people on board for a lot of these different topics is the biggest challenge when you have an organization with over 20,000 people in it. You know, there are a lot of people who are very pro-environmental everything, and then there are a lot of people that are very anti-environmental everything.
Right.
And so there's quite a wide gamut, and depending on, you know, there's just a lot of politics internally to deal with. But I would love to connect and hopefully make some progress in that space.
Oh, wonderful. Well, that is Mike Waller, the Director of Sustainability at Rochester Regional Health. You just heard from Heidi Fritz, Healthcare Director at Greener by Default. And we're also joined today by Dr. Jane Van Dis, co-founder of OBGYNs for a Sustainable Future. We're going to take a short break, but if you're listening to Environmental Connections right now and this is getting you going and you want to take part in our conversation, we'd love to hear from you. If you're watching us on the live stream on YouTube, feel free to leave a comment there. You can also call us at 844-295-8255 or 585-263-9994. When we come back, we'll dig in a little bit more into what sustainability efforts can be done, should be done, aren't being done when it comes to the world of hospitals. We'll be right back.
I'm Megan Mack. Monday on The Next Connections, we sit down with the team at City Magazine for one of our monthly conversations. And this month, we're talking all things wellness. That's the theme of the February issue of the magazine. We'll take your questions, your comments, and we'll talk with the team at Citi about what's on their radar when it comes to the wellness scene. That's Monday on Connections.
Welcome back to Environmental Connections. I'm Jasmine Singer, and if you're just joining us today, we're discussing hospital sustainability and the environmental impact of healthcare systems. In the first half, we explored the major sources of carbon emissions in hospitals and ways to reduce medical waste, among many other topics. I'm here today with Mike Waller and Dr. Jane Van Dis, and joining us remotely is Heidi Fritz from Greener by Default. Let's turn to the policy side of sustainability in healthcare. Dr. Waller, Rochester Regional Health has committed, as you mentioned, to sourcing 100% of its electricity from renewable sources. What challenges would hospitals face in making this shift?
I think we're very fortunate in New York State. We have a lot of incentives and policies that allow to go for renewables much more so than other states. And so, you know, depending on where you're located, there can be a lot of challenges just to make that financially work. We have a lot of policies and incentives to make something like solar work financially. On the flip side, we also have some of the lowest rates in the country here in upstate New York, because when you think about how electricity flows in New York State, it pretty much just all flows downstate to New York City, and it's all generated upstate. And so because we're so close to the generation, we have some of the cheapest prices. Mm. So that makes the renewable projects more difficult to pencil. But even with these low prices and all the incentives that we have in New York State, it still makes financial sense.
Hmm.
And other parts in the country, it might not be the case.
Dr. Van Dis, turning to you, are there any promising policy changes or regulations on the horizon from where you sit that could help encourage hospitals to operate more sustainably?
Well, I think if you had asked this question before the previous election, the answer would be that there were a lot. However, I think even in the last few weeks, we've seen information about climate change and sustainability getting scrubbed from the federal websites. So, you know, for instance, to Mike's point, I know that NYSERDA, for instance, offered hospitals in New York State to cover 75% of the salary for a hospital sustainability manager for 2 years.
Wow.
Which is amazing, right? So that's a huge, generous incentive. And so there are absolutely ways, as Mike mentions, that policies can promote local positive sustainability efforts. I think whenever we're talking about sustainability, one of the things that Mike referenced, actually, I feel like Mike and Rochester Regional is a perfect template, is that two things have to happen. Number one, you have to have champions in the C-suite. You have to have executive support for these types of programs. And then secondly, you have to conduct what he referred to as audits, right? So you want to be able to measure where your emissions are coming from, because then you obviously can enact specific changes or policy changes or requirements for your purchasers so that you meet some goals that you set yourself. Now, Healthcare Without Harm is the nonprofit side of the work that I do, but then they also have a for-profit organization called Practice Green Health. And Practice Green Health helps hospitals and healthcare organizations across the country perform these audits and really get down into the exact bylines and numbers in order to then create, a goal for, as Mike showed, 2025 or 2026. We want to reduce this waste, or we want to increase the purchase of renewables in this way. So there are a lot of tools out there. It's just a question really of whether or not I think a hospital or healthcare system wants to avail themselves of them, and whether or not they have a champion in their C-suite.
It's a really good point, Jane. I mean, do you feel hopeful that we'll get there? I mean, you are embedded in this day in and day out in what I see as a very, like, kind of in quite the dichotomy, because you work in the emergency room and you care deeply about these issues. So where does that leave you, and where does that leave us?
Yeah, well, I think on a local level, I recently was appointed, and I'm now serving on the board of the Genesee Finger Lakes Climate Accelerator. And so that's a local nonprofit that helps to join with other organizations and lobby in Albany and tell the public. I volunteer at the Brighton Farmers Market as part of Color Brighton Green. I do think actually the public can play a huge role in demanding that some of the largest employers in this area, Rochester Regional and URMC, start to make some of these changes. You know, obviously working from the inside, I do everything I can, but I actually think the public can play a huge role here in, you know, asking their doctor when they go to the visit about whether or not, you know, the metered dose inhaler that they're using has carbon emissions associated with it or not. So I want the public to know that they actually can make a difference too.
I love that. Feel emboldened if you're listening to this. And feel emboldened to give us a call, 844-295-8255, 585-263-9994 if you're local, or you can comment on our YouTube live stream. Heidi, turning back to you, food is, as we were discussing, a major part of the sustainability conversation, but it's often overlooked in hospital policy discussions. How can hospitals be encouraged to take food sustainability more seriously?
You know, one of the things that we found that's really helpful is to approach this from doing a pilot project on a short-term basis and just collecting some data, being able to show impacts of that on the food sustainability in particular, you know, how do menu changes impact the amount of carbon emissions that you have or the amount of food cost, et cetera, and then be able to take those results to leadership and have some great discussions about, you know, how could we implement this permanently? What else do we need to do? It's a little easier to get some buy-in sometimes for a short-term project. And so I think that's one way to drive decisions about long-term policy.
Has anything surprised you? I'd love to hear a story or two from what it's like to do the work you're doing.
Well, it's been really interesting. We've been working with not only sustainability folks, but food service and nutrition folks, other dietitians. I'm also a dietitian myself. Sometimes it's medical students and nurses that come to us and they think, you know, I really want to see more plant-based food, not just from a sustainability standpoint, but also just from a health standpoint. And we're working with really cross-sector, cross-divisional teams to bring this project to healthcare food service. So that's been a lot of fun. And there's a lot of creativity involved for the chefs and culinarians involved. And then, you know, opportunities to really showcase another area of sustainability that isn't often talked about.
Yeah, and you started with New York City. I mean, Mike, does that give you hope if, like, you know, they were like, let's do it in New York City. If they could do it there, don't you think we could do it in Rochester? Just try and get a few more plant-based by default when it comes to sustainability efforts?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the biggest challenges that in healthcare we have with a lot of these issues that we try to tackle are all of the regulations that we have to follow. So hearing that they did in New York City, you know, we're under the same regulations for the most part. So at least when that question comes up, you know, well, I will know the answer to that one.
Well, should sustainability efforts in healthcare be centralized at the hospital level, Mike, or should there be a broader governmental push to enforce green policies across the industry?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that you kind of get into the philosophical debate on how we regulate healthcare organizations, right? We're very heavily regulated industry, and for very good reasons, but you know, there's an argument to be made that we're too overly regulated, that drives up cost. And so trying to figure out the balance between that. Actually, with our composting program, years ago, New York State came out with a rule that if you're a large food waste generator, you have to figure out how to do something with it besides send it to the landfill. And so restaurants and schools, and they originally included hospitals in that group as large generators of food waste. And so that's what actually drove our composting program to start. And then when the law actually came to fruition and got passed, hospitals were not a part of it. And so there are a lot of industry groups that try to get hospitals to not be as regulated as they are for lots of reasons trying to find that balance, I was a little bit disappointed because we had actually figured it out. We were saving money. It was something that was totally doable. And then there wasn't a regulation for that particular problem. But, with all that being said, it is challenging to figure out that balance.
Well, if there were to be more regulatory oversight, it seems unlikely at this point that it would come from the federal government. Is this an issue that the states are likely to get involved in?
I personally don't think so. Not with hospitals. I mean, at least with some of the issues that have affected us in the past few years, it doesn't seem that hospitals usually get a pass on for all of the ones. The one that came out with Styrofoam, which I really appreciated, that was a really tough thing to figure out. But they banned Styrofoam in New York State, and so it just became pretty easy to get rid of it in hospitals. We weren't exempt from that. So hopefully, I think as these regulations come out, they're not too costly for the healthcare system, so there won't be much pushback on it.
Something that I've seen is that, one of the topics that I lecture both nationally and internationally on are the health effects of plastic exposure. So not only the little pieces of plastic that are in our food and in our air and our water, but also all of the endocrine disrupting chemicals contained within those plastics. And so, for instance, I'll be going to Albany next month to talk about PFAS, which is one of the chemicals in plastics. And, you know, I do think that from a legislative or policy perspective, hopefully there could be a connection made between how these chemicals are impacting our health. And that's absolutely the reason that I got into wanting to understand and study this, was because I was seeing more and more of my patients sicker and sicker with hypertension, especially in pregnancy. So I do think that if we can make a good argument to the legislators in Albany about why exposure to plastics and chemicals is deleterious to human health in New York State, then some of the types of policies that could come about. For instance, just in January 1st of this year, we saw that PFAS intentionally added to textiles is now illegal in New York State. So there are little ways that we could push the industry, the healthcare industry, to think about the way in which their plastic use. Remember, U.S. healthcare is the single largest purchaser of single-use plastic in the United States. So connecting the health effects of plastic to the fact that we purchase more single-use plastic and we waste more single-use plastic, hopefully, you know, maybe there could be a policy entry into that.
I'm seeing that more and more making the headlines, Jane. And, you know, to me, that's shifting a little bit. Is this something, because you've been tooting this horn for a long time, do you think this is shifting?
I do. You know, for those listeners that might not know, I have a TikTok channel and I talk about plastics and health on my TikTok channel.
What is it? Tell our listeners.
It's at Jay Vandis, J-V-A-N-D-I-S. And my largest video so far is a video about the study that came out of New Mexico where the researcher took the brains of decedents who had no family members, and he spun the brains and then he performed mass spectrometry on the brains and found that in some of the 60-some plus people, their brains were 0.5% plastic. Now, 0.5% might not seem like very much, but we did not evolve on this planet to have plastic embedded in all of our organs like it is now. And so, you know, one of the things that happened in that video was I pointed out that like a lot of the plastic that's going into our bodies is coming through food packaging. And, you know, when you look at those rotisserie chickens under a heat lamp, the heat and the fat are actually accelerating the plastic into the food and then obviously into our brains as well. And so people were up in arms about the the rotisserie chicken, but they were also up in arms about the idea that our brains are filled with plastic, and could that be influencing our IQ or our rates of dementia? And the answer is, it's entirely possible, right? Because we have seen IQ levels going down generation after generation and dementia rates going up. So,
I grew up in those fluorescent 1980s when we basically ate, Nutrisystem microwavable meals.
That's right.
And I don't even know if we owned dishes because we just ate out of the plastic
the
thing.
Microwave, yeah.
So as our medical doctor on the panel, am I going to die?
No, Desmond. Because actually, the more whole plant food that you eat, it actually helps your gut microbiome. And it's thought that the level of the gut microbiome is where your body has the potential to eliminate the plastics that you're ingesting. So eating a whole plant-based diet actually is the best thing you can do to limit the amount of plastics in your body.
Wow.
So I have a question for you, if you don't mind.
Please.
Years ago, there was a study that came out that said, I think it came out of Australia, that said in Western countries, we consume on average a credit card worth of plastic every week. And when you dug into it, the majority of the plastic just came from water. And so, you know, in Western countries, the wastewater treatment plants, they're not capable of cleaning out all of those little microplastics from when we, like, wash our clothes, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the majority of it comes from water, but shellfish and other things that we commonly consume, you know, if you microwave anything, you're getting a lot of plastic.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that study.
I did.
How accurate is that?
Yeah, it's interesting because I've actually seen people debate that study. And I think that right now there needs to be a better study, because while there is evidence that there are huge amounts of plastic that we are consuming and exposed to every week, whether it's a credit card's worth or not, I think is up for debate. But I will say, to your point, for instance, in healthcare, you have the opportunity to choose what types of scrubs that people throughout the hospital wear. And recently, our hospital chose to move to 100% polyester away from a cotton poly blend. And then each of these scrubs, the top and the bottom, come individually wrapped in plastic. So here's a way in which a simple decision now will likely increase the amount of microplastics going into the waterways here in Monroe County. But thank goodness we have RIT and the University of Rochester with that $7.3 million grant to study microplastics in our water. But you're right, Mike. Tires are actually a huge source of microplastics in the water as well. Mm.
Well, I thought Mike was going to say, am I going to die?
No, no one's going to die.
Well, actually, my medical opinion is that we probably are at some point, not the doctor. I want to talk about scale really quickly before we have to conclude. Some hospitals are implementing these changes, but what would it take, Mike, to spread sustainability efforts across the entire healthcare sector?
Yeah, it's a challenge, right? These are in sustainability science, we say these are global issues that have inherently local solutions.
Yeah,
and you know, like you mentioned earlier, finding champions to do this work is challenging, and so I think, you know, having discussions like this, but also just trying to talk to as many people as we can and inform them on how much power that they actually have on these issues, whether it's just simple decisions that they make every day, or if they go and talk to their manager or their coworkers or whoever it is, you know, if you get a large multitude of voices really asking and driving for these changes, they will happen. And so there are groups that kind of coalesce all these folks, like Practice Green Health, Healthcare Without Harm, that, you know, are trying to bring all these people together to go and do that at their respective health systems.
Heidi, turning to you, can sustainable changes be made to hospital diets that would not increase costs, might even decrease them?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, if you look at some of the lower carbon protein choices like beans and lentils and soy foods, those are far less expensive than most animal-based proteins. And so we've seen in a lot of pilot projects the ability to significantly reduce food costs on top of reducing emissions as well. And I just want to say, too, thank you, Dr. Van Dis, for your comment about plant-based eating and that being helpful in terms of your overall health, because I think this is really a win-win when you're looking at the food that's served in hospitals. It's not just about the sustainability aspect, but, you know, we all need to eat more fruits, vegetables, and get more fiber in our diets, no matter what.
And you say it's a win-win because it's also as you're saying, as Dr. Vandis is saying, one of the best choices that can be made for the planet. That was Heidi Fritz, healthcare director for Greener by Default. As we close, really quickly, Mike, for listeners who are healthcare professionals or hospital administrators, what's one concrete step that they could take today to start to make their hospitals greener, real quick?
I would say, again, it boils down to the age-old mantra of reduce, reuse, recycle. So, you know, the biggest emissions generator is our supply chain in the healthcare system. If you can figure out ways to reduce the amount of items that we purchase, one of the best ways to do that is to switch to reusable items. That hits all three of those, reduce, reuse, recycle. There are also reprocessed items, where it's single-use, but you can reprocess it, buy it back. Those are some of the simplest concrete steps that all healthcare professionals can take in their area of control.
That's Mike Waller, Director of Sustainability at Rochester Regional Health. Dr. Jane Vandis, for the rest of us, patients, visitors, and the public, how can we help push for greener hospitals?
Well, I actually think you can have a conversation with your doctor about what their sustainability practices are. In my area, obviously, I mentioned a reusable metal speculum versus the plastic one. There are also opportunities, as Mike pointed out, to reduce waste. They did an audit of emergency rooms, and they found that in the trash in 24 hours, there were over 200 unused items that had made their way in the trash. So it is absolutely a culture change. It's a culture change in the cafeteria, and it's a culture change in the purchasing. But it could also be a culture change in the conversation that you have with your doctor. And that's where I think the public can really make a difference.
Dr. Waller, Dr. Vandis, Heidi Fritz, thank you all so much for sharing your insights, for the incredible work you're doing, for having this discussion with us. As you said, it's not one that's had enough, and I'm just so grateful that you're going there. And thank you to Emily Eli Tex-Trucano and Marianne Sullivan for their help in producing today's episode. That's it for today's episode of Environmental Connections. I'm Jasmine Singer. Until next time, thank you for making today's Environmental Connection.